happening for too many people. Through history and from the old ages, people used to ask questions about the world to come, about the experiences that are going to happen after death. Now, some people during their lifetime have this chance to get to have some points, some touch of the other world. But when they come back and they explain about the experience they had, it's sort of unbelievable, and it's very hard to believe all what they discuss about. So this experience of going to another world, seeing some metaphysical things that maybe they exist right now, but we are unaware of them, is very difficult to understand. I would like you to help us understand this issue and the process of having these sort of experiences.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. As for your question, I have to say that the concept of death and also resurrection or going to the other world or passing this world and transferring to the other world has been among the inevitable questions and issues of all religions, namely Abrahamic religions. I said all religions, then accepted the Abrahamic religions to say that even other religions, up until the time that they have not been distorted, even it was a case, an issue of discussion and controversial issue among all Abrahamic and non-Abrahamic religions. So it's very interesting for people to know what is going to happen after they actually die, when they enter the day of judgment, and let's say...
Sorry to interrupt you, and I think it's because since it's the world of unknown, it's interesting for everyone to know what happens over there.
Definitely.
So I think that's why it's not related to religion or a special culture. Yeah. Everyone is interested to know what happened there.
Definitely. But I wanted to reach to this conclusion that later on in those distorted religions, those who faced problems with the ideology and worldview that they had with, they come to ignore this issue. So it is not more interesting for them, and they don't like to pay attention to that.
They ignore the afterlife?
The life after this life, yeah. Because in modern human is trying to forget what is going to happen after his death. And even they sometimes come to nullify and to nullify all the theories have been said and mentioned, or even whatever has been mentioned in the words of the scholars or the leaders of the religions. So this was the difference. I said that it was a case for the Abrahamic religion. Then, in case even other religions have not been distorted, it was also an interesting issue for them.
Yes.
So that's why I actually differentiated between these two. All in all, this is really interesting because we like to know what happens after we leave this world, to know what is going to happen there. And what is our situation like, whatever has been said and narrated is true or not, but there are even some ways to catch this information and to get to this information earlier, even before we die.
Yes, that's very true. So, and you, please, can you just give us a touch upon that issue?
First of all, let me look at these phenomenon from a philosophical perspective.
Yes.
You see, according to the Muslim philosophers, not only the Muslim philosophers, but also the ancient Greek philosophers, so the truth or the essence or the true nature of the human being is its soul, not the body.
Yes.
So soul is the exact or the true nature or the essence of human being.
Mm-hmm.
So this, when it comes to the soul and to the spirit, you can say, the soul is some immaterial kind of existence.
Just a question. Do yes. all people from all religion believe in the spirits and souls? Do they believe
I'm
that
I'm not sure
human
about all
beings?
Religions, at least for Abrahamic religions, mm-hmm. we are sure that they do believe in this kind of a phase of life where we can say transcendent kind of world. But when it comes to the Hinduism, I'm sure that, yeah, they do also believe these kind of things. But for the rest of religions, I have no idea. I did not have any kind of studies in this regard. So since soul is completely and perfectly a kind of immaterial existent, So it is possible for the soul to get extension from the body or from the limited kind of material things.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is even possible that the person can do it under his own control, because we've had kind of sort of maut-e-ikhtiyari in the history of
they
the mysticism.
They go through some sessions, special sessions and rituals.
Yeah, mystics or let's say these kind of people, they have had these kind of experiences that they can get, that they can extend or spread their soul
they
out.
They can travel to the metaphysics.
Of course, yeah, to experience or to perceive kind of immaterial realities.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to the possibility of these kind of experiences based on the teachings and doctrines of Islam, particularly from a mystic or philosophical perspective, it is quite possible that there's no problem with it.
So now we're speaking of mysticism and philosophy. Now I wonder, scientific issues do not accept the spirits or the souls?
Why not? You know, we can provide...
I mean, has it been scientifically proved?
Of course, recently, if you search through the internet, you find lots of articles, essays, books that are written on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of physicians, doctors.
Exactly.
They did lots of projects researching on this idea, on these kind of issues. So since lots of people from different cultures, from different societies, countries, from different religions, they share these kind of experiences with the doctors, with the physicians. So that's why, since numberless people, we can say, from across the globe, they have had these sort of experiences, and they tell us about what they perceived in that kind of experiences. So it's a kind of pieces of evidence that prove the existence and the possibility
of this.
It has
been proved, because many of them have the same experience.
Of course,
I mean, some part of their experience are just alike.
Yeah, there are certain commonalities between all these kind of experiences. So they have some shared and common kind of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So when different people from different cultures, different religions, they speak about these kind of speech, what these kind of experiences, and they have some shared and common kind of grounds or experiences in these sort of out of body, we can say, experiences. So then it is of course a proof. It's a kind of even scientific sort of evidence.
Yes, so up until now we came to the conclusion that a human being has got, as far as we know, has got two dimensions, the physical part and the metaphysical part, which is the soul, and we agree upon that fact. Now the question is, the experience that these people have in their life, a sort of virtual death before the actual death, and they have the chance to come back and retell their stories. How could we justify these experiences? Are they hallucinations? Are they illusions? Or they're just actual things?
Actually, we cannot call them illusions. They might be true and might not be true, because we cannot actually verify the experiences of others. I cannot verify and approve your own experiences, and you cannot do the same for me. So what we, based on the, let's say, the knowledge that we have about the soul, and as you rightly actually concluded, that we believe that human body is actually made of two important parts and factors, body and soul. Let us say spirit and body. So yes, the experiences of every person are unique for himself or herself, and nobody can actually ignore and improve it 100%. But they can be true, because based on the powers that human beings have and the spiritual powers that they have, as the brother referred to, the willing death, maut ikhtiyari, so people can go and experience these things before mutu qabla anta mutu, when we are asked based on the Islamic recommendations, mm-hmm. try to die before you are going to be dead.
Before the actual death.
Before the actual death. But on the title that you have actually selected for that, I am a little bit doubtful to say, to call it a virtual death or let's say actual death. This cannot be called a virtual because this is also a real and actual transition to the other world, but it's not a complete one.
Then it's safer to put it this way that... Yeah. In a time of a kind of disease or sickness that might lead into inactivity of the brain?
Even not that form, because, you know, sometimes we can do it while we are quite safe and we are quite healthy.
Like the mystics do.
Even not non-mystics can experience the same thing.
Now it's very complicated.
Yeah, so everyone can have this experience. Mm-hmm. So, but... To say that this experience is true or not, we cannot judge.
But for sure, in those moments, the brain is inactive.
The brain is inactive because, you know, brain is, as the brother said, is a material and physical part of the body. But whatever is going to, our experiences comes from our souls.
Yes.
So the experience that we are talking about in this show is just our spiritual experiences.
Yes, a spiritual
So they experience. Can come to everyone, mm-hmm. a person who is a sick person or a person who is fully healthy, and to everyone that comes in any time and in any era can happen to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been advised by Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha, the peak of eloquence, to think of the death before you die. And you see, throughout the Nahj al-Balagha, we see lots of recommendations of Imam, that Imam very delicately and accurately defines how this transition is going to happen. And when we think about these, recommendations, something might even come to the pupil when you think too much about something it might even come to yourself.
Yes.
See? And
that's why some people call it illusion, because they say you think too much about something, you focus upon it, and that mm-hmm. happens to you.
Yeah, I've heard in the biography of Sayyid Ayatollah Sayyid Al-Qadi rahmatullah alayhi, that he once asked that he has been asked about such issues, that where do you know these issues, and where did you experience such things? He said, while I was in graveyards studying Nahj al-Balagha, mm-hmm. those phrases of
it's
Imam.
Very interesting.
Those phrases of Imam about the death and reminding the life after this life.
That's going into the depth of each line.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. Mm-hmm. We have to have a very wrap-up situation in which I will tell you that we're speaking of death and the separation of the soul from the body. And we talked about some very interesting stuff. Thank you for listening to us.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question related to the beginning of the last surah of the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nas. As you know, in this surah, if you've had the time to glance over the surah and its contents, you know that in the beginning of the surah, God Almighty refers to himself using three attributes, three sifats, three of his divine attributes and beautiful names. First is Rabbin Nas, the Lord of men. Second is Malikin Nas, the sovereign and the king of men. And the third is Ilahin Nas, the object of worship of men, the Lord of men. Right, so today we're going to be examining why is it that God Almighty has referred to himself using these three attributes. And also a second question, which is kind of tied up to the first, is why is it that he has mentioned these three verses without a conjunction, meaning without a waw? Usually, like some of the verses of the Holy Quran, right, one verse is connected to the previous verse by means of a conjunction, for example, and, right? Or in Arabic, we say wal. In other words, why did God not say, قُلْ أَعُوذُ بِرَبِّ النَّاسِ وَمَلِكِ النَّاسِ وَإِلَهِ النَّاسِ? Seek refuge in the Lord of men and the King of men and in the God of men, or the object of worship of men. Right. So regarding the first question, we can say that the reason why God Almighty has referred to himself using these three attributes is that these three attributes, right, are the reason why we should seek refuge in him. Right. Sometimes in the Holy Quran and also in Arabic, right, an attribute is mentioned for the subject of a ruling, which is in reality the reason for the ruling itself, right? So in the context of what we're talking about, the reason why we should seek refuge in God is because he is the Lord of men. He sustains men. He is the sovereign and king of men, meaning he has the power to take care of us and repel this danger from us, as well as because he is the object of worship of men. These three attributes are the reason and the cause for why God deserves to be the object and the being to, in which we seek refuge from this danger. Regarding the second question, which was, why is it that these three verses have not been connected using a conjunction or a wow or the word and, we can say that the reason for this possibly is because, according to some Quranic commentators, is because each of these three attributes is an independent, can serve as an independent and separate reason for the ruling or why we should seek refuge in God. I mean, even if God didn't have any other attribute besides the fact that he was the object of worship of men, we should seek refuge in him. Even if he didn't have any other attribute besides the fact that he is the sovereign and the person who governs and he has the power over all beings in this universe, we should still seek refuge in him. Okay? Or even if he didn't have any other attribute except for the fact that he was the Lord of men, we should seek refuge in him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the first three verses of Surah An-Nas. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we looked into the adverse effects and potential dangers of psychotropic drugs. We went to France, the number one user of such medication, to see how psychotropic drugs prescribed much too readily and in a cocktail to cure feelings of anxiety and depression have in some cases led to madness, suicide, extreme acts of violence, and murder. Yet the root cause of the extensive use of such drugs seems to be much more than naive and ignorant doctors and desperate patients, especially when a multi-million dollar industry is at stake. Stay with us for the rest of the documentary.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. This great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No, I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
All right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question?
Okay.
Well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
These ads banned in France reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed. For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer. This is what Michael Baum denounces, a lawyer specializing in the pharmaceutical industry. This man is a nightmare for the laboratories. His trials have cost them billions of dollars. His theme, denouncing the addictive effects of medication.
One of the issues with these drugs is once you're on, you can't get off. They become a captive audience. And they get trained, basically, the patients get trained to stay on it. It's It's if they take the drug and then stop the drug, they start experiencing these brain zaps, or they start experiencing these nausea symptoms or these severe headaches or dizziness, and then they take the drug, they take it back, they go back on it, and it goes away. Well, they get reinforced with the concept of, I need to stay on it. And they think that maybe, and what doctors used to think, was that they were relapsing back into their depression. That isn't what was happening at all.
The dangers of psychotropic drugs have been well known for a long time. Since September 1991, the American Medication Agency has had to react against waves of complaints against Prozac, the grandfather of modern antidepressants. This drug has been blamed for hundreds of suicides and murders, and administration officials are getting together to determine whether a correlation exists between Prozac and acts of violence. In front of this committee of reputed psychiatrists are the families of victims.
My husband didn't believe me. He was a pharmacist. We came back, and on April 30, he just blew his brains out in front of all of us. How many more have to die before somebody looks? If we made a mistake, we're humans.
After being on Prozac for 21 days, my wife shot and killed both of these two boys right here. She turned the gun to herself and shot herself twice. I heard these people talking about scientific data. For those that don't say we have scientific data.
I entered therapy 1 year ago as a victim of rape. I stand before you today a victim of Prozac. It baffles my mind to think that a prescription drug I could simply compare to a felony of rape. But yes, they can be compared, because if a drug robs you of your will to live, then it has committed a felony equal to that of rape.
She shot herself on the head.
This was the date of my first...
For a whole day, witnesses will make statements. It's overwhelming.
I firmly believe the drug...
The internist...
How many more people are going to be killed and maimed before you do something? You have the power to change things. You have the power to listen to what we say and investigate what we say. We need help.
Following the statements, the committee votes.
There is credible evidence to support a conclusion that antidepressant drugs cause the emergence and or intensification of suicidality and or other violent behaviors. Those in favor of that statement vote yes. Those opposed to that statement, no.
There is total surprise. Unanimously, the committee declares that there is no link between Prozac and the violence described by the families of the victims.
Vote on the following statement.
Jeffrey Lieberman is a member of the committee. Later, he goes on to be the all-powerful president of the American Psychiatric Association. And of the 10 psychiatrists present during the vote, 9 of them had conflicts of interest with one or several pharmaceutical companies. When Prozac was launched, the Lilly Pharmaceutical Company worked very hard. But one of the board directors even denounced the methods he had himself used to boost sales of the drug. He is John Virapen, and he was director of Lilly in Sweden until 1988. And it's not his style to beat around the bush.
We are not patients, we are consumers. And we are being ripped off right, left, and center. And unfortunately, as I see it today, the drug companies have the power, total power. They are in all corners of the industrial complex. They're in there somewhere, doing dirty work.
And you were a part of it.
And I was a part. That's why I'm able to tell you all of this. I was a part of it. I've done, my hands are dirty. I'm trying to clean now. It's redemption time.
It's time for redemption. And John Virapen has written a book with a provocative title, Side Effects, Death. Notably, it discusses the way in which he was asked to conceal side effects.
The doctors prescribe to the patient, but don't tell them anything because they don't know. They rely completely on what the pharma industry tells them. These little salesmen that run around, I was a salesman too, and they used to instruct me when I was a salesman. The first thing is, you don't talk side effects with doctors.
Why do they do that? Because
They want to make money, 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 money. They don't care about your lives. They only care about their wallets.
From conferences to interviews, John Virapin does not hesitate to reveal what he implemented to encourage sales, corruption, gifts, and trips
to children.
General practitioners, they don't usually get to go to big Congress and World Congress here and there. So one day I got the idea that maybe we should do something with these guys. So I gathered a whole bunch of them and took them to Singapore. Fly them down to Singapore and gave them works. I mean, it was exclusive. When they came back, my sales escalated.
In light of these accusations, Lilly, the lab that created Prozac, did not wish to meet with us. But this is what they said by email. John Virapin has not been employed by Lilly since 1988. He therefore cannot be considered as a credible source of information concerning the current activities of the group, its motives, or practices. The Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, like all the others, nevertheless fought hard so that the American administration did not impose a black box warning on antidepressant leaflets, an explicit caution against the risks of suicide or violent behavior. But in 2004, finally, it became a done deal. This victory is owed to the activism of victims' families and their lawyers, such as Andy Vickery. The pharmaceutical industry also has a bone to pick with this Texan. He also received billions in compensation during the famous arrangements whereby laboratories preferred to pay out rather than stand trial. To better explain how a pill can kill, he makes use of a puzzle. His demonstration, he claims, applies for all psychotropic drugs.
Is there a phenomenon, a distinct phenomenon, of Prozac-induced suicide?
The first attribute is the patients became suddenly suicidal. People who've never thought of killing themselves, of harming themselves, take one of these drugs, whoom, they go instantly from that feeling to death. The second piece of the puzzle was that the suicides were all violent. I've shared with you already the story of Pat Williamson. She was on Prozac 9 days when she came in one morning to her husband and said, "Honey, would you show me how to kill myself?" And her husband said, "Oh, Pat, please." And he decides to go check up on her after 15 or 20 minutes and finds that she has made 100 mutilating cuts in her body. The third piece of the puzzle that Eli Lilly noticed was an obsessive quality to the act. It's just this sudden impulse to do something really violent, really dangerous to themselves or others. And it's just, they're just overwhelmed by it. They're obsessed with the idea and they cannot control their behavior. In the period of time between the person starts to take the drug and the time of their death or suicide attempt, that there's abnormal behavior. Something different is going on. And sometimes the medical help is, "Oh, you just need to take more of this drug. Let's increase your dose." It's like, "Oh, there's a little fire. Let's pour some gasoline on it." And the final piece of the puzzle is, almost all of the cases that I have handled, the death has happened within 30 days of the time the person either started the drug or had their dose increased.
Once again, Lilly Laboratory only answers our accusations by mail. They explain that one of the most striking studies in the last few years shows that there is a decrease in suicide, negative 32%, and in mortality, negative 49%, when depressed patients take antidepressants. But what is the truth? This study is contested by other studies that claim the contrary. And if in the United States, thousands of victims came to the forefront, then why would France be spared, the leading consumer worldwide of psychotropic drugs? In April 2014, a court trial would clarify the current state of affairs in an enlightening manner. Back in December 2008, Jean is depressed. He struggles to deal with his professional life, and at the birth of his son, he attempts suicide.
He therefore went to the psychiatrist, Dr. Gosseres. The doctor recommends that he try out a new antidepressant, which was not yet available on the market, Brintellix. Jean did not react to the treatment. The psychiatrist proposed to double the dosage. A few days later, Jean set himself on fire. Corinne, Jean's wife, refused to believe that it was a random suicide. She alerted the authorities, and Dr. Gosseres was put under inspection on 7 charges. He was accused of embezzlement, but worse, putting others' lives in danger for at least 8 patients, including Jean, Corinne's husband. On April 30th, 2014, the doctor was strangely judged in Bordeaux, the court where he himself was a judiciary expert. He received a suspended sentence of 6 months that he appealed. But why would the pharmaceutical company Lundbeck, the creators of the antidepressants, not be investigated themselves? The pharmaceutical company Lundbeck has no interest in this affair going public. They've invested millions in order to get Brintellix approved by medical authorities. However, Jean was not at all the same since his dosage of Brintellix was raised, as described by Corinne and her mother. For Lundbeck, it is therefore not Brintellix that is to blame, but Jean's depression. It's a credible defense, which is used by all pharmaceutical companies when they are blamed. However, we also met with other victims of this trial period, and bizarrely, they all describe the same symptoms. Such as Christian Mounier, who also tested Brintellix for 8 months. Since, he has lost his job, his memory, and he describes himself as a vegetable. A man who is no longer himself, another who commits suicide, apparently devastating side effects for 8 sufferers. But there was also the suicide of 2 more patients just after coming off Brintellix. This bad streak should have alerted the authorities. However, nothing would come of it, as on the same day as Jean's self-immolation, Dr. Gosseres wiped his name from the file. His death was therefore no longer related to the clinical tests. The medical authorities explained to us that for each test of a drug, they only receive the results achieved across the whole territory. The botched trials of Dr. Gosseres were therefore lost in the mass and mixed with several other accepted studies across the world, as this document shows that makes Brintellix's market release official. Lundbeck throws the blame back to the public health authorities. So what can be said of the package insert that we found in the United States, where Brintellix has been approved since 2013? Side effects are documented in 2 whole pages. Especially, though, the principal paragraph warns against the raised risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors. It's the famous black box warning. In other words, the highest alert level. In France, Brintellix has just been approved for sale on the market. It has therefore been judged as useful in fighting depression. The doors are slammed shut. Jean is responsible for his own atrocious suicide, just like the death of Mark, Aurélie's murderous thoughts and suicide attempt, or the fall of Christian Mounier. If the effectiveness of such medication on most serious depressive states cannot be denied, how many more tragedies need to occur before the effects of psychotropic drugs on some patients are truly recognized?
It seems that as long as money and power are involved in the realm of healthcare, pills that are expected to cure depression actually cause suicide and murder. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye. Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Dr. Shum Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tarbiyah is very important, not only topic, very important responsibility, and very humbling, actually, responsibility. It's very difficult task, because you have difficulty, first of all, in improving yourself. We are not exactly what we like to be. I don't think any of us would be 100% happy with himself or herself. Those who are happy with themselves, either they have underestimated their potentials, or maybe they are suffering from self-admiration and from ujub. Otherwise, we cannot be happy, and we are not certainly happy. More or less, we all know of our problems. But now the challenge is more when we want to make another person able to improve, when we want to do tarbiyah of our children, our students. It's more difficult. So it's not something easy. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is quoted as saying, إِلْزَمُوا أَوْلَادَكُمْ وَأَحْسِنُوا آدَابَهُمْ فَإِنَّ أَوْلَادَكُمْ هِدْيَةٌ إِلَيْكُمْ إِلْزَمُوا أَوْلَادَكُمْ can mean look after your children, can mean don't neglect your children, can mean spend time as much as possible with your children. Ilzamu. Don't let anything separate you and your children as much as you have control. Sometimes things happen that you have to be away from your children. Sometimes it's for na'uzubillah, inshallah, go through it. But for example, you become ill in the hospital for some days, some weeks. You cannot see your children, or you cannot spend that much time with them. Sometimes for, I don't know, work, etc. But as long as you are able and you have ability to plan, try to spend time with your children. Unfortunately, we think that when our children, this is my experience I share with you, that I'm not saying definitely this goes clearly in our mind, but maybe consciously, unconsciously, we think like this, that our children would need us more when they grow up. For example, I may think that my children, when they become 18, 20, 25, 30, 40, they may need me more. They need my attention, my time, my support more. And now that they are children, we just need to look after them, feed them properly, dress them properly, put them into good school. And the more I can work and save, for example, money, or the more, for example, I can, you know, do my own studies, etc., it's a saving. Later, when they need me more, I try to make myself available. This is a misconception in the minds of many parents. Some people told me in the past, you know, that, for example, they worked almost day and night, especially some immigrants, to save money for their family and children, buy house for them, you know, save money to send them to good school, etc. But day and night they were working. They were not with the family. But the fact is this, that the younger they are, the more they need us, and the more they benefit from us, and the more they appreciate us. And if we spend quality time with them when they are very young, there is a chance that in future also they may say, Father, Mother, I need you. I want to talk to you. I want to benefit from your advice. I want to discuss with you. If we don't give that care and attention when they are very young and want to spend more time with them because now they are more mature, more understanding, I can share with them, you know, many things. If we don't spend good time with them in the beginning, at this point, there is already so much of distance between us, emotionally, intellectually, socially, that they may not actually find us interesting. They may love us and respect us as parents, but not as someone that they want to talk or benefit from. So we have made a historical mistake that there is no way to sort it out, to fix it. Because of that misconception that we thought in future they need us more and in future I can spend more time with them. But the fact was that they need you more when they are younger and when they have eyes and ears more open to you and hearts more open to you. And it is amazing that when they are very young, how much they come to us. Even sometimes might be tiring or annoying, you know. You want to do something, you have come home, for example, you want to rest, you want to eat, I don't know, you want to study. Maybe your child is climbing your neck, you know, etc., shoulder. Sometimes you enjoy it, but after some time you feel, no, that's too much. But these are all blessings. And later, if you spend, you know, time, energy, money, you cannot rebuild this relation.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Ali. غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
sunrise.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the human dignity, and we said it is a parcel of the human being, if not the essence of the human being. And when that dignity is violated and taken, then obviously everything falls apart. And all these rights that we have revolves around and try to protect that human dignity. Human being, in the sight of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam, he sees this creature as a very dignified creature, and he has inner traits, like inner pure godly traits. And when I say godly traits, is because the Quran says, وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِي, and I have blown into him from my soul. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala obviously does not possess a soul, but he's trying to say he put something divine in the human being. And Amir al-Mu'mineen looks into the human being as that. And because of that, Amir al-Mu'mineen worked hard to try and to protect and maintain all the rights of the human being, be it the personal rights or social rights, such as the right to live, the right to safety, the right to equality, the right to education, the right to learning, the right to freedom. And all of these things were applied to its best at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen's government, when he was in power. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, did not just say these things by words, verbally, or he has written them, but in fact, he applied them. He was the embodiment of human rights himself. And he created the right environment to make sure that these laws are applied. And anyone, be it a Muslim or a non-Muslim, when they read the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, they can see that his main objective in life was to preserve the dignity of a human being in any way or shape possible,